Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, February 24th, 2022. Primary election takes place March 1st by Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL, at BigBendSentinel.com. Tri-County. The March 1st primary election, in which voters will nominate a number of local and statewide candidates for the general election this coming fall, takes place across the state on Tuesday. Voters will nominate candidates to represent the Democratic and Republican parties in local county elections, district-based congressional and legislative offices, the State Board of Education, and judicial seats. Candidates for governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, land commissioner, agriculture commissioner, comptroller, and one of three seats on the railroad commission will also be on the ballot. Successful candidates in the March 1st primary election will go on to the general election on Tuesday, November 8th, with elected officials taking office in January 2023. All polling locations in the Tri-County area will be open March 1st from the hours of 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. On Election Day, voters are required to vote in the precinct in which they are registered to vote. Precincts are designated on voter cards. Voters unsure of their precinct or polling location can find out by entering their information in the My Voter portal through the Texas Secretary of State website. Voters need to present a valid form of identification at the polls. Valid forms of ID include a state-issued driver's license, U.S. passport, Texas election identification certificate, Texas personal identification card, Texas license to carry a handgun, U.S. military ID card with a personal photo, or a U.S. citizenship certificate with a personal photo. Presidio County, Precincts 1 and 7, Marfa Visitor Center, USO Building, 302 South Highland Avenue, Marfa, Texas, 79843. Precincts 2, 3, and 4, Presidio County Annex, Building C, 301 East O'Reilly Street, Presidio, Texas, 79845. Precincts 5 and 6, Presidio American Legion, 915 O'Reilly Street, Presidio, Texas, 79845. The following local positions are up for election in Presidio County: County Judge, District County Clerk, County Treasurer, County Commissioner Precinct 2, County Commissioner Precinct 4, Justice of the Peace Precinct 1, and Justice of the Peace Precinct 2. Check out our questionnaires for Presidio County Public Office candidates online. https://bigbendsentinel.com/tag/candidate-questionnaires/. Brewster County, Precinct 1, Sunny Glen Cooperative Building, 2209 West Highway 90, Alpine, Texas, 79830. Precinct 2, Judge Val Clark Beard, Office Complex, Old Library, 203 North 7th Street, Alpine, Texas, 79830. Precinct 3, Marathon Community Center, 2nd and Avenue E, Marathon, Texas, 79842. Precinct 4, Alpine Civic Center, 801 West Holland, Alpine, Texas, 79830. Precinct 5, Panther Junction Community Room, Big Bend National Park, Texas, 79834. Precincts 6 and 7, Red Patillo Community Center, Highway 118, Study Butte, Terlingua, Texas, 79852. Precinct 8, Food Pantry of Alpine, Incorporated, 933 East Gallego Avenue, Alpine, Texas, 79830. The following local positions are up for election in Brewster County. County Judge, Judge Eleazar R. Cano is leaving office after serving as County Judge since 2015. District Clerk, County Clerk, County Treasurer, County Commissioner Precincts 2 and 4, Justice of the Peace Precincts 1, 2, and 3, Constable Precinct 1. Jeff Davis County, Precincts 1, 2, and 3, First United Methodist Church of Fort Davis, 200 Front Street, Fort Davis, Texas, 79734. Precinct 4, Valentine Community Building, North Main and 8th Street, Valentine. Precinct 5, Davis Mountains Baptist Church, 101 Broken Arrow Trail, Fort Davis, Texas, 79734. The following local positions are up for election in Jeff Davis County. County Judge, District County Clerk, County Treasurer, County Commissioner Precinct 2, County Commissioner Precinct 4, and Justice of the Peace. Illustration by Crow Crumbs for the Big Bend Sentinel. Big Bend Regional Medical Center. Hospital combines med-surg with emergency room, sparking local concern over health and safety. By Allegra Hobbs. A-L-L-E-G-R-A at BigBendSentinel.com. Alpine. At the end of January, Big Bend Regional Medical Center undertook a significant restructuring of its hospital operations due to a staffing shortage. Moving forward, what had previously been the med-surg unit, or general care for hospitalized patients, would be absorbed into the emergency department. Operations for both departments would be run out of the same area of the hospital, which had previously only been the emergency room. In the weeks that followed, locals who witnessed the newly combined operations have raised concerns over the ramifications for patient care. Last Thursday, at the most recent Board of Directors meeting for the Big Bend Regional Hospital District, Melinda Richardson, until recently the EMS Director for the City of Presidio, now its CFO, posed a question during the public comment period. Could the board provide an update on the status of Alpine's Big Bend Regional Medical Center, specifically with regards to ongoing diversions and a recent decision to combine med-surg with the emergency department? I just think it's important for the community to know, remarked Richardson. What is the status? J.D. Newsom, the board's executive director, agreed, but said he had no update to offer in terms of staffing or otherwise, but he'd heard patient volume had decreased that week. Richardson noted that there was not much information coming out of the hospital, but that EMTs were reporting a chaotic scene. You hear everything's coming up roses, but then you go into the ER, and I know these guys have said it's just rather chaotic, she said. Accounts from patients who have visited the hospital's emergency room in recent weeks support this characterization. as does the account of a local EMT who frequently brings patients into the hospital. The EMT, who requested anonymity, said this decision had an immediate negative impact on the emergency department's functioning due to overcrowding. The emergency department previously had enough rooms to accommodate 8 beds, said the EMT, but in the days after the department had absorbed MedSurge during the first week of February, the EMT observed that only 2 rooms were available for emergency room patients and that the overflow resulted in unrelated ER patients sharing rooms while others lingered on beds in the department hallway. They literally have patients sitting in beds in the middle of the hallway for everybody to see, said the EMT. There is just no privacy whatsoever. The EMT recounted having to put a patient they had been transporting in the waiting room because there was no bed available for the patient. The EMT expressed concern that the lack of space for emergency patients will compromise the quality of care available. This will cause critical and serious patients to face a very high probability that they will not have a room for them and result in people waiting for care, even if they are critical, said the EMT. 2 patients who visited the ER the following week, the second week of February, provided similar accounts of overflowing rooms, and both told the Big Ben Sentinel that patients were relegated to gurneys in the hallway due to a lack of space. Alpine resident Michael Turcotte, who went to the ER on the night of February 7th, recounted being treated on a gurney directly outside the room of a COVID-19 patient because there was no room for him elsewhere. The door to the COVID patient's room was open and there was no curtain, and the COVID patient was not wearing a mask because they were receiving oxygen. According to Turcotte, hospital staff confirmed the patient in the room had COVID. We were there for over 3 hours, and that's kind of scary. That's considered close contact under all the CDC rules, said Turcotte. Turcotte said he was sharing the hallway with another unmasked patient who was also on a gurney. She was in a lot of pain, he said. She was moaning and groaning and finally went to sleep. Turcotte said that hospital staff told him this shortage was due to the recent consolidation of the emergency department with MedSurge. They told me they had no beds because all the patients in the general hospital had been moved to the emergency room area, he recalled. He stressed that he had no complaints about the staff who were treating him. They were doing the best they could under the circumstances, he said. Another patient who requested anonymity told the Big Ben Sentinel that they had been admitted to the emergency department with COVID-19 and were put in a room with an elderly patient who did not have COVID, according to the elderly patient's wife. He was having breathing issues, but he did not have COVID, the patient recalled. An elderly man having breathing issues and breathing heavily, just with the slightest little movements being put in a room with somebody who has COVID, was probably not a good scenario for him. The only thing between them was a curtain, the patient said. The patient also said that when walking through the hallway, they observed patients in the hallway on gurneys. When reached for comment, hospital spokesperson Ruth Huckey said the restructuring was temporary and that new nurses are slated to start work at the hospital in March, which will address the staffing shortage. Facing staffing struggles nationwide, an uptick in Omicron patients, and FEMA and temporary nurse contracts ending, we implemented an interim solution to keep as many patients at Big Bend as is safely possible, said Huckey, who added that hospital staff makes changes according to patient volume. As cases of COVID-19 increased and staffing challenges persisted, we converted same-day surgery rooms to medical surgical rooms to care for more patients. Hospitals are well-trained in repurposing different areas of hospital to meet patient demand. We currently operate 8 emergency department beds, a triage bay, and overflow rooms depending on volume fluctuations. Hucky further said that the hospital follows COVID-19 safety protocols in accordance with CDC guidelines, including additional safety precautions for patients with known positive status, wearing protective equipment, and providing medical-grade masks and hygiene products for all patients and visitors. Patients entering the emergency department are quickly screened for COVID, Hucky added. Staffing issues at the hospital have been a long recurring problem. Beginning in July, a nursing shortage forced the hospital's labor and delivery wing to reduce its hours of operation, intermittently shutting down for days at a time. At the time, Hucky said the hospital was actively working to address the shortage and hire new nurses. The problem persisted, however. The labor and delivery wing was closed for an uninterrupted 2 weeks in December, then EMS Director Melinda Richardson said at the time. Turcotte expressed concern as a resident of the community who relies on the hospital for health care services. If all of us want to continue living here in this region that we love, we have to get this under control and have decent medical care, he said. Court proceedings begin for Fort Stockton man charged with child endangerment after Big Bend National Park disappearance. By Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL at BigBendSentinel.com. Alpine. Hector Flores Jr., a Fort Stockton man facing charges of child endangerment after he and his 9-year-old daughter went missing in Big Bend National Park earlier this month, made his first appearance in court this week at the Western District of Texas Alpine Courthouse. Flores, 49, and his daughter, who was identified in court proceedings by her initials, LF, entered into Big Bend National Park on January 28th and were officially reported missing February 5th. When park volunteers and rangers discovered their abandoned vehicle off of Old Ore Road. They were found over a week later, on February 14th, near Boquillas del Carmen in Mexico. Following the land and air search, which involved both federal and state agencies, as well as Mexican law enforcement, LF was taken into custody by the Child Protective Services Division of the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services, and Hector Flores Jr. was arrested and charged in federal court with child endangerment. The charge is a state jail felony in Texas, punishable by 180 days to 2 years in jail and a fine of up to $10,000. Though Flores is being charged in federal court because Big Bend National Park is a federal jurisdiction, court documents indicate that prosecutors are assimilating Texas state law. Flores has been held at the Brewster County Jail. Witnesses who spoke at the preliminary hearing provided further insight into the series of events leading up to Flores' departure into the park and what happened while he and his daughter were missing. Notably, evidence suggests the disappearance into Mexico was planned well in advance. Judge David Fannin of the U.S. District Court, Western District of Texas, presided over the case, with Flores' lawyer, criminal defense attorney Shane O'Neill, and prosecutor assistant U.S. Attorney Scott Greenbaum arguing the case. Court proceedings were carried out via Zoom. Alice Downey, special agent with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, was the first witness to appear. The FBI first became involved in the investigation on February 6th. Downey said what appeared to be a campsite was located near Flores' abandoned vehicle, which was located a quarter mile off of Orr Road, one of the least traversed roads in one of the most remote parts of the park. She said rangers and law enforcement found empty food cans, books, clothing, as well as what appeared to be a marijuana pipe at the site. An additional pipe, likely used for smoking narcotics like methamphetamine, was found next to some tracks nearby to the campsite, she said. The FBI agent approximated the distance between Flores' abandoned vehicle and the Mexico border as a minimum of 20 miles. She said the duo would likely not have hiked in a straight line and would have had to traverse rugged terrain like rocks, mountains, and cacti. Downey said investigations suggest the series of events was out of the ordinary, but Flores and his daughter's trip to Mexico appeared to be premeditated. Flores frequented the Fort Stockton Public Library, where he would conduct research on the internet and check out survivalist books, witnesses said. Books about how to survive in the wilderness, as well as the novel 1984 by George Orwell, were checked out but never returned, Downey said. The agent said prior to driving into Big Bend National Park on January 28th, acquaintances of Flores reported he spoke of wanting to live off the grid in Mexico or on a ranch in Presidio. Prior to rooming with a friend as of May 2021, Flores and his daughter were living out of his vehicle, Downey said. The person with whom they were living was unaware of them leaving town, the agent said. Another focus of the proceedings was on LF's access to adequate food, water, clothing, and shelter. Agent Downey said LF reported their food supply ran out after 3 days of camping and hiking, and they were eating cactus fruits in the desert. She said LF estimated they went 20 days without food, but in reality it was closer to 14 to 15 days. The agent reported the pair was going through their water supplies fairly quickly and decided to fill up a water jug with water from a puddle they came across. Flores had water purification tabs, which he utilized at that time, according to LF. In regards to LF and her demeanor when found, the FBI agent said based on images she had seen of the child, she appeared to be fearful. It was revealed that locks of hair that had been found at the initial campsite did belong to LF, who asked her dad to cut her hair off because it was getting dirty. Upon returning to the United States, LF spoke with a child advocate from the El Paso Police Department, said Agent Downey, who went through the series of events with her. LF said the original plan was to drive into Mexico, but when their car broke down, they decided to walk instead. She said her father told her the reason they were going to Mexico was because there was going to be a large earthquake that would cause a tsunami, and Mexico was going to be a safe island. Flores volunteered statements, said the FBI agent, telling Mexican authorities he thought an apocalypse was coming and telling the Park Service he and his daughter got lost. Sean McCaffrey, park ranger with Big Bend National Park, also testified as a witness. While it remains to be seen if Flores will be granted bail, O'Neill argued that his client is not a danger to the community, while the prosecution argued Flores is a flight risk. The court decided to reconvene Friday, February 25th. The U.S. Attorney's Office for the Western District of Texas declined to comment further. O'Neill told the Big Bend Sentinel that Flores was optimistic about the trial and was glad his daughter was doing well. He said Flores is in contact with his daughter and his parents, who are taking care of her at this time. He also said that in reaching out to Flores' friends and family, everyone described him as a single father who was dedicated to the care of his daughter. Lack of candidates leads to cancellation of local elections. By Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL at BigBendSentinel.com. Marfa. The joint general election for both Marfa City Council and Marfa ISD School Board that had been slated for May 7th will be canceled due to a lack of candidates vying for the positions. Applications for 3 City Council and 4 Marfa ISD School Board seats closed last Friday, February 18th. Neither the City nor the School Board reported any contested races for open seats, meaning applicants will simply be appointed without an election. City Council. The terms of 3 out of 5 current City Council members, Yosef Ben-Yehuda, Buck Johnston, and Eddie Payares, are up for re-election. Payares was the only council member to file for re-election. Payares first took office in November 2020 and said he decided to continue to serve on the City Council in order to take care of unfinished business, and that he's learned a lot about budgeting and maintaining city systems thus far. Marfa resident Mark Cash, who previously served on the Marfa ISD School Board, was the only other applicant, meaning one City Council seat will be vacant. Cash did not respond to requests for comment for this article. Because Payares and Cash are running unopposed, they will automatically be appointed to the positions. Even though a canvassing process will not be required, Payares and Cash will not enter office until late May or early June, as is customary. The 3rd open seat will remain vacant for the time being until Payares and Cash can be sworn in, said City Secretary Kelly Perez. At that point, the new council can request letters of interest and appoint someone to fill the vacant seat or hold a special election, which would not occur until next November. The city will cancel the general election in which council members are typically voted on, but will proceed with a special election on May 7th, in which voters will decide whether or not to renew the quarter-cent sales tax, which allocates money for street improvements and is set to expire this year. School Board. Unlike the city, the school board has enough applicants to fill open positions, but none of the seats are contested. Superintendent Oscar Aguero confirmed they would cancel the election, which they have done in the past when similar situations have occurred. Also, unlike the city, school board candidates must indicate which specific seat they intend to run for when filing. The 4 school board candidates filed for 4 different seats. Ernie Villarreal filed for place 5, which he has only held since fall 2021, when he stepped up to fill an unexpired term of Mark Cash. "I am honored to be able to serve on the Marfa ISD School Board," said Villarreal. "This will be my first full term, and I am looking forward to working with current school board members, administrators, teachers, and all staff for all of our students." Board Secretary Teresa Nunez also filed to keep her Place 7 seat. She has been with the school board for 10 years. "We have a great program, and I am also excited to be working along with my fellow board members to make it even better by focusing on our academics and building a bright future for the students," said Nunez. Lori Flores will step up to fill the unexpired term of Katie Price Folks, Place 2, who recently resigned from the board. Flores, who also serves as the city utilities clerk, will be returning to the board after leaving 2 years ago. Ruben Martinez filed for place 6, currently held by Sean Ruggett, who has opted not to run for re-election. Martinez has an 8th-grade daughter at Marfa ISD and is a maintenance tech crew chief with the Texas Highway Department. He said he has been wanting to run to join the school board for a while now and is looking forward to starting a new chapter by serving on the board. "It will be my privilege to work with other school board members, the administration and staff of Marfa ISD, to continue working together and sharing the knowledge toward a better education for the children in our community," said Martinez.
"Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, February 24th, 2022. FSISD approves bond propositions. The Fort Stockton ISD School Board took a critical step to improve and upgrade the school district in all facets at Wednesday's regular meeting and set in motion a new compensation plan that will revamp the retention and recruitment system for educators. Fort Stockton's approval of a bond election was at the center of discussion at Wednesday's school board meeting. All 5 bond propositions were passed unanimously and will now go up for a vote during the May election. The total of the bonds is $110 million. FSISD Superintendent Dr. Gabriel Zamora and Rose Kanuski, McCall, Parkhurst, and Horton attorney noted at Wednesday's meeting that if the bonds pass through the election, it will not raise the district's tax rate that is currently in place. Both referred to the mandatory language that will be presented to voters during the election when mentioning the tax rate. Rarely do you have a district that finds itself in a position you can look at having a bond without impacting the tax zone," Zamora said. It says on there, "because of law, this is a property tax increase. I want to put it on the record that is 99% not the case for here. It is law that is to be on there." Kanuski explained that it'll be the board members' responsibility to make it known to voters that the tax rate will not increase if the bond passes. "It will have the educational component when you give the facts of the bond election to explain that in your case, the mandatory language is not scary and actually false. It's just going to be on you to plug that message." The breakdown of the bond is as follows. Proposition A, $84 million. "For the purposes of designing, constructing, renovating, improving, upgrading, updating, acquiring, and equipping facilities and any necessary or related removal of existing facilities, the purchase of the necessary sites for school facilities, and the purchase of new school buses." Proposition B, $12 million. "For the purposes of designing, constructing, renovating, improving, upgrading, updating, acquiring, and equipping school stadium facilities and related infrastructures." Proposition C, $6 million. "For the purposes of designing, constructing, renovating, improving, upgrading, updating, acquiring, and equipping school facilities, namely housing for teachers." Proposition D, $3 million. "For the purpose of acquiring and updating technology for school facilities." Proposition E, $5 million. "For the purposes of designing, constructing, renovating, improving, upgrading, updating, and acquiring and equipping school recreational facilities." Teacher pay structure revamped. "In an effort to retain and recruit educators, the FSISD School Board approved an addition to the teacher, librarian, and nurse salary schedule on Wednesday's school board meeting." Zamora explained that the additional structure to the pay scale will feature zones instead of steps and give insight into the new salary schedule. "If they meet the criteria and expectations of those zones, the schedule is designed to retain and recruit the most talented individuals out there. My hope is that we can make the statement that for certain, teachers that are doing the right thing for FSISD can become the best school district in our area and even outcompete some of the larger districts out there." the scale that is currently in place, which gives out pay increases on a yearly basis, will stand for employees that do not meet the zone's criteria. Current employees and new employees will have the opportunity to enter the zone's pay scale at any point in their career, no matter their previous experience within the district or at other districts. Zamora noted that the pay structure implementation will not officially be in place until June at the earliest. We're putting it out there that we're provisionally approving it. I will not hire anyone under this schedule until we solidify it, although I have had the attorneys vet it and it is legal. The additional salary scale will be in addition to the stipends that are currently in place for educators that teach in testable subject areas. Blown tire leads to fatality of Pecos County resident. A single car crash 32 miles east of Fort Stockton on Interstate 10 resulted in one fatality and another to be in serious condition on February 19th. Sheffield resident Rain Nicole Stevenson lost control of a Dodge Durango heading eastbound on I-10 near the mile marker 292 after the left rear tire blew out on the vehicle on Saturday at 2 o'clock p.m. The vehicle left the roadway and collided with a rock wall, causing the driver to be ejected from the vehicle. Passenger Stacy Medina, 48, of Sheffield, survived the crash and is in serious condition at Medical Center Hospital in Odessa. Stevenson was pronounced dead at the scene by Justice of the Peace Wooten. Joe's Place to open its doors this weekend by Jeremy Gonzalez. Located in downtown Fort Stockton, Joe's Place will be opening its doors this weekend. Owner Joe Espino has announced a soft opening for either Friday or Saturday from 5 p.m. to midnight and a formal grand opening event to be announced. We are definitely striving for Friday or Saturday, he said. We just want to make sure that the team is ready. The business hours will remain Fridays and Saturdays from 5 to midnight until we have a strong foundation set, and then we can look at opening more days. We want to start small and learn as we go so that we can provide the best experiences for our guests. Espino mentioned that the historic building has been in his family for generations and was formerly run by his grandfather and great-grandfather. I'm trying to keep the family history of this building alive. My grandpa worked hard to provide a quality place for people to relax and unwind. He worked this place for 50 years until 2001, when we had to close the doors from one day to the next due to his Alzheimer's. From 2001 to 2016, the building just deteriorated. So I came in and had some major restorations done. Recently, I had it open as a private event venue. It always made my day to hear all the stories of past, so that's actually one of the reasons I wanted to open it back up as a public bar for the public to relive their memories or make new ones if they've never been here before. The resurrected bar will pay homage to the past as an elegant saloon. The famed building now has mood lighting, spacious indoor and outdoor seating, a digital jukebox, dance floor, and certain elements were kept original, like exposed 100-year-old adobe bricks. Joe's Place will be serving mixed drinks, cocktails, tap beer, and bar foods. We're going to start with a small food menu, he continued. We'll start off with loaded fries, loaded nachos, fried pickles, stuff like that. We do plan to expand the food menu in the future. The beer will be served super cold. We built a walk-in cooler directly behind where the tap beer is. No lines run across the bar. It's direct access to cold beer chilled at 33 degrees. Crediting his team for making the opening possible, Espino revealed the bar will be run by his brother-in-law, who took mixology courses in Dallas and shares the vision of hosting memorable nights. This wouldn't be possible without a good team. I'm also proud to be among other great establishments. I would love for downtown Fort Stockton to be a place where people can go from venue to venue. I want my guests to go to the Classic Man and to the Old 76. Albert Valadez's place is going to be outstanding and beautiful. I can envision downtown as a walking district one day. That's what I want. But with that said, Joe's Place will be a Cheers environment with a Texas twist. For more information, check out Joe's Place on Facebook or Instagram at Joe's Place FS. local election to decide three races by Nathan Huer. Registered voters will have the opportunity to decide three local races for their respective parties in the upcoming primary election on March 1st. The Republican ballot for Pecos County District Clerk will be the most contested race, as three candidates will vie for the seat. Sylvia Guerrero, Tammy Lujan, and Darla Coode are candidates for the position. The winner will go on to claim the district clerk seat in Pecos County, as there are no candidates for the position for the Democratic Party. Republicans Dudley McIsaac and Nathan Reeves are running for Precinct 4, Pecos County Commissioner. The winner will go up against incumbent Santiago Cantu, who is running for commissioner as an uncontested race for the Democratic Party in the November election. Democrat Ruben Salinas, Precinct 1 Justice of the Peace incumbent candidate, will be opposed by Oscar Gallegos. The winner will face Republican Rankin C. Mitchell, who is an uncontested race during the November election. Voting will run from 7 to 7 on March 1st. The following is the locations for each precinct. Precinct 1, for Senior Citizen Center, Fort Stockton. Precinct 2, Courthouse Annex, Fort Stockton. Precinct 3, Sheffield Community Center. Precinct 4, Ira Ann Community Center. Precinct 5, Old Schoolhouse, West Highway 11, Girvin. Precinct 6, Cuyahnosa Community Center. Precinct 7, Rural Community Center in Fort Stockton. Precinct 9, Imperial Community Center. Precinct 10, Fort Stockton Public Library. Panther Pictures to open with The Batman. Fort Stockton's newly renovated theater, Panther Pictures Fort Stockton, announced last week that their first showing will be the movie The Batman, starting on March 4th and running through March 6th. The show will be the first to have former Twilight star Robert Pattinson as the new Batman, replacing the former Dark Knight Ben Affleck. Tickets went on sale online on February 23rd on the theater's website. Showtimes had not been announced as of the morning of February 23rd. See the theater's website and Facebook page, Panther Pictures Fort Stockton, for more information.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahan's News for Thursday, February 17th. Monahan's woman dies in fiery crash Monday morning. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A two-vehicle fiery crash left a 78-year-old Monahan's woman dead early Monday morning. Frankie Aline Weeks was pronounced dead at the scene by Justice of the Peace Danny Bustos. According to preliminary reports by the Texas Department of Public Safety, shortly before 10 a.m., Carlos Alberto Varela Cortez, age 28, of Great Bends, Kansas, was driving a 2007 Peterbilt truck tractor with trailer westbound on Interstate 20 just before mile marker 80. Weeks was driving a 2019 Hyundai Santa Fe southbound on Ike Street, approaching the Interstate 20 service road. Weeks disregarded the stop sign and crossed over the service road, and then continued through the barrow ditch and vaulted over the safety cable wire onto the interstate. Ferreira Cortez's truck tractor was then struck by Weeks' vehicle and caught fire in the roadway. The Monahan's Volunteer Fire Department was called to the scene to extinguish the blaze. Ferreira Cortez was not injured as a result of the crash. Both drivers were wearing their seatbelts at the time of the crash, and the weather was clear and dry. The crash is being investigated by Trooper Joseph T. Arena of Monahan's and assisted by Trooper Michelle Montoya of Kermit. Early voting brisk in first 2 days. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. A steady stream of voters cast ballots at the Ward County Clerk's office, as early voting will continue until February 25th. At the close of business on Tuesday, a total of 283 ballots had been cast, 274 Republican and 9 Democratic. The county clerk's office, located on the first floor of the Ward County Courthouse at 400 South Allen Street, will be open from 8 a.m. until 5 p.m. through Friday, the office will be closed on Monday, February 21st, in observance of the President's Day holiday. Voting will resume on Tuesday and will continue until February 25th. Sample ballots may be obtained for review at the clerk's office. The primary election will be held at precincts locations on Tuesday, March 1st. Polls will be open from 7 a.m. till 7 p.m., and voting locations are precincts 1E, 2, 3N, and 4E will cast ballots at the Ward County Event Center at 1525 East Monahans Parkway. Precinct 1W will vote at the Barstow Community Center at 100 East Concho Street. Precinct 3S will vote at the Grand Falls Community Center, 700 North Avenue A. Precinct 4M will vote at the Wicket Community Center at 501 North O'Brien Street. And 4W will vote at the Pyote Community Center at 1108 North Ward Street. Mail-in ballots must be received by Tuesday, March 1st, Election Day, at 7 p.m. if carrier envelope is not postmarked, or Thursday, March 3rd, 2022, the next business day after Election Day, at 5 p.m. if carrier envelope is postmarked by 7 p.m. at the location of the election on Election Day. Several Ward County political seats are being contested this year, all on the Republican ballot. For District Clerk, Tommy Lujan and Valerie Romo are seeking the post. Incumbent Patricia Oriabides is not seeking re-election. County Commissioner Precinct 2 incumbent Larry Hanna is facing a challenge by Joel Greiner. For Justice of the Peace Precinct 1 and 4, incumbent Danny Bustos is being challenged by Dolores Navarrete. In Precinct 2 and 3, Elizabeth Morales and Roy Bean are seeking the post. Incumbent Elizabeth Polanco is not seeking re-election. Uncontested seats in Ward County are County Judge Greg Holly, County Clerk Denise Valle, County Treasurer Carly Ennis, County Commissioner Precinct 4 Eddie Nelms, and County Chairman Hal Upchurch. Other races of local interest in Ward County are United States Representative District 23 incumbent Tony Gonzalez is being challenged by Alia Garcia and Alma Arredondo Lynch. State Representative District 81 incumbent Brooks Landgraf is being challenged by Casey Gray. State Senate District 31, with incumbent Kel Seliger not seeking re-election, has drawn four candidates, Kevin Sparks, Jesse Quackenbush, Tim Reed, and Stormy Bradley. Additionally, several statewide positions are on the Republican ballot. There are no local races on the Democratic Party ballot, but several statewide posts are on the ballot. Hospital receives grant to start renovations. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. Ward Memorial Hospital received a $3 million grant from the Florence Marie Hall Foundation, along with another $1 million USDA grant that will allow the first steps of modernizing the hospital, CEO Leticia Rodriguez told the managers in last Thursday's meeting. In a meeting of the Ward County Commissioners last July, the recommendation of Rodriguez to modernize the existing hospital in lieu of building a new facility was approved. The new grants will allow the hospital to move forward in the first phase of modernizing patient rooms by enlarging rooms and bringing bathrooms up to be ADA compliant. A new emergency room, a renovated radiology department, and an updated physical therapy clinic has already been done. Quote, "Instead of a new hospital, we can renovate in stages to take advantage of work already done," Rodriguez told the commissioners in that meeting. The next steps will be to get new architectural plans and start seeking bids for the patient room renovation, which should start in the next few weeks. Managers present for the meeting were Dr. John Fawcett, Larry Hunt, Frank Heslin, Lisa Stewart, Angel Fuentes, and Gerald Carlson. Managers Tommy Escamilla and Jeff Burdick were not present. A proposal from Telecom Unlimited of Abilene to install new telephone cabling throughout the hospital and Sand Hills Family Clinic was approved. The work will replace the aging cables. The quoted cost, including materials and labor, is $46,000. The project can begin in about 6 weeks. The time to complete the project was not stated. At the recommendation of Rodriguez, extra shift pay for full-time nursing staff, RNs, and LVNs was approved by the managers. The increase will be from $2 per hour to $4 per hour for working an extra shift. Nurses must have worked their scheduled hours to qualify. The extra shift pay is in addition to any overtime pay. Quote, "This will be less expensive than bringing in traveling nurses, as those agencies are now charging as much as $100 per hour now," Rodriguez said. An agreement with Julie Hardcastle of Crane was approved for her to provide training services for business office staff. Hardcastle has retired and has agreed to lend her expertise to the staff on an as-needed basis. Hardcastle has many years of experience in managing a hospital business office. She will be paid $52 per hour and receive 25 cents per mile for travel. The agreement can be canceled by either party with 30 days written notice. Homer Peak, a physical therapist assistant, was named as the Shining Star recipient for the fourth quarter of 2021. The Shining Star Award is based on nomination by peers, and the recipient will receive a $100 stipend and a reserved parking spot for a month. Quote, "Homer is always willing to learn new things and is always polite, friendly, and well-respected by patients and staff," Rodriguez said in presenting the award. Commissioners approved new EMS billing service. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. Ward County Commissioners, meeting in regular session on Monday morning, approved a new agreement for emergency medical services billing. The proposed agreement with Digitech would be the greater of a $50,400 fee, or 6% of all billings, which is almost double from the existing agreement. The current fees are 10.25% of collected billings. EMS bills about $300,000 per year, so the new Digitech agreement would increase from about $30,000 to $50,400. The new agreement will be with Emergicon LLC of Dallas, has no upfront costs, but will be paid 9% of all revenues collected. The agreement will require the Ward County EMS to purchase their own equipment, computers for ambulances, and software, which, at an approximate cost of $12,000 for hardware and software, resulting in a first-year cost of about $49,000. Software cost for subsequent years will be about $1,500 per year, for a cost of $28,500 per year, based on $300,000 in collections. The expected life of the hardware, computers, is about 5 years. The bid of Southwest Marketers of Monahans to provide fuel for the county was approved. No other bids were received. The cost for regular unleaded gasoline was quoted as $2.79 per gallon and $2.20 per gallon for number 2 diesel. Based on the volatility of fuel prices, an allowance for price fluctuations is also included. Although the bid documents asked for fuel cards as well, no bids were received for the fuel cards. A donation of $10,000 from Chevron Products Company was acknowledged. The letter from Chevron recommended supporting community programming, such as Meals on Wheels. Quote, Melanie Venable, Ward County Senior Center Director, said no funds are needed for food, so I recommend the funds be placed in the Senior Center account for their use as needed, Ward County Judge Greg Holly said. In routine business, Minutes of the January 24th meeting and county officers' reports were approved. The next meeting of the commissioners will be held on February 28th at 9:30 a.m. at the Ward County Courthouse, 400 South Allen Street. The meeting is open to the public. Swanson sends two to prison for felony drug charges. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. 143rd Judicial District Judge Mike Swanson handed down two prison sentences last week on charges of possession of heroin and manufacturing or delivery of cocaine. Lexis Breanne Gish, age 23, of 600 South Calvin Street, waived her right to a jury trial and pleaded guilty to the felony offense of possession of a controlled substance, penalty group 1, less than 1 gram, a state jail felony. Gish was sentenced to 18 months confinement in the state jail division of the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. According to the indictment, on June 30, 2020, Gish did intentionally possess heroin in the amount of less than 1 gram. She was also assessed a $1,500 fine and ordered to pay $393 in court costs and $180 in restitution. Isaiah Luis Natera, age 29, of 500 North Doris Street, was sentenced to 4 years confinement in the Institutional Division of the Texas Department of Criminal Justice after being adjudicated on a charge of manufacturing or delivery of a controlled substance, penalty group 1, greater than 1 gram, less than 4 grams, a second-degree felony. According to the indictment, on November 10, 2017, Natera did knowingly possess and with the intent to deliver cocaine in the amount of more than 1 gram, but not more than 4 grams. Natera was originally given deferred adjudication for the offense, but failed to meet the requirements of the agreement. Attorneys for the state on both cases was 143rd District Attorney Randall W. Reynolds.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West, Texas.
Both judgments
This is the recording library of West Texas,
8th.
Enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.